Welcome, everybody. I'm John Feddersen, and for the North Carolina Reading Service, bringing you this week's edition of The Independent from IndieWeek.com. And that dateline of this issue is July the 11th of 2024, and its first broadcast on our station on July the 12th. And so here we go. Now, as our studios were closed on July the 4th, last Thursday, I have a backlog of articles, and I'll get to some of the past articles and the ones from this issue, the current issue of IndieWeek.com, right now. And the first concerns a visit for U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. And he was in Durham for at least two presentations and events over the holidays and then after. On Thursday, he and Leonardo Williams of Durham, Governor Cooper, and several other local leaders walked a half-mile stretch along Holloway Street from Antioch Baptist Church to the Village Shopping Center. Nearly the entire path was a treacherous hike over gaping holes, giant tree roots, and makeshift gravel walkways with almost no sidewalks. A vivid illustration of a much-needed investment in local infrastructure. Luckily for Durham residents, the investment is coming in the form of $12 million for improvements from the federal government's $1.8 billion Rebuilding American Infrastructure with Sustainability and Equity. That's acronym RAISE, R-A-I-S-E. It's a grant program and will pay for new curb ramps at 33 intersections, plus new sidewalks, street crossings, and bus stop upgrades, including new shelters, lighting, benches, and bike racks along Holloway Street, which is a main transit corridor for Go Durham. Buttigieg said, "You've got a community here that has been left out of some of the historic rounds of transportation infrastructure investment, and we're changing that. It's going to matter to neighbors, it's going to matter to businesses, and it's going to matter to the congregation of Antioch Baptist Church." Durham's Holloway Street project is one of 148 projects across the country receiving RAISE funding. The project area represents almost one-fifth of Go Durham's total ridership, and the Go Durham 3B3C route along Holloway is the city's busiest, with nearly 3,300 weekday riders. Mayor Williams said today, "We get to fill a gap that needed to be filled. This is an opportunity for us to truly build community. In Durham, we define a wholesome community as being able to address affordable living." Buttigieg praised the work of community activists who have long advocated for improvements along this corridor, saying, "I want to applaud the community taking a much more intentional approach here and making sure that community voices are included in the designs and plans that are put forward. If you walk this stretch of Holloway, it's clear that there needs to be a better standard of service, and we can deliver that." The tour stopped outside the Morolian supermarket at the Pupuseria Doña Laura food truck, where Buttigieg and others met with Go Durham employees and held a brief press conference before celebrating the historic investment over pupusas. He said, "There are part of my jobs you can't do from behind a desk in Washington. Being able to walk the streets with the mayor, to crisscross the region with the governor, to have a conversation with Durham Congresswoman Valerie Fouché, who was just quizzing me from her seat on the committee and oversight in Washington, and now be on the ground in her district, I think just reflects the way these decisions and policies people talk about in Washington have a very specific impact on people's everyday life." The city of Durham has already made notable commitments to improving transportation infrastructure. City staff included over $230 million in this year's budget for new and ongoing projects and a $115 million bond for streets and sidewalks will be on the ballots this November. Improvements to the Holloway Street corridor are currently in the design phase, and construction is expected to begin in 2026. City Transportation Director Sean Egan says, what we hear so often from the community is, when are we going to see on-the-ground improvements? Residents and transit riders have filled out so many surveys, and they're done with the plans and the surveys. They want to see results on the ground that are making it easier to get to and from the bus stop. This grant is the difference between us just planning and being able to actually build the improvements that our community has been calling for the last 4 years. And I'll include a different article, which was published before July 4th on the 2nd. And it's the U.S. Transportation Secretary and Governor Cooper broke ground then on the 2nd on a new high-speed rail line that will link Raleigh to Richmond, marking that project's first phase, which includes constructing a bridge to carry Durant Road over a railroad line. And this is a $1.3 billion project funded by the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. It's the largest grant ever received by the NC Department of Transportation. It will provide passenger service between downtown Raleigh and Wake Forest by 2030, and is the first leg of a planned high-speed rail connection between Raleigh, Richmond, Virginia, and the Northeast. Buttigieg told reporters this is the beginning of a new chapter in passenger rail in North Carolina, and really one of the biggest projects we're supporting anywhere in the country. The stop marked the first on Buttigieg's national summer construction tour. He will visit Winston-Salem on Tuesday and then return to Durham. And I just read you that article. Cooper highlighted the role of passenger rail in improving connectivity and reducing carbon emissions during the ceremony. Now, this project will use the existing S-Line rail corridor. That's a freight corridor currently owned by CSX. Virginia has already acquired its portion of the land, and North Carolina officials are finalizing a deal to purchase the corridor in our state. In May, the White House announced it has allocated nearly $454 billion from the bipartisan infrastructure to over 56,000 projects around the country since that passage of that $1 trillion bill in 2021. North Carolina is set to receive over $9 billion in funding from this law from 512 projects. Funding includes about $630 million for clean water projects, $175 million going toward replacing toxic lead pipes. And Governor Cooper said North Carolina has done very well in investments from the federal government with this bipartisan legislation. I'm so grateful that President Biden got this and other major pieces through that really are generational investments that will help our children and our children's children. Let's continue now with more future plans, which involves drinking water. And this article, again, on July the 3rd, Durham has plans to use Jordan Lake as a drinking water source. The bird spins in the air, dives low over the water, and yanks a fish out with its talons. A heron, watching from the riverbank, squawks jealously and lunges at the osprey. But with its long legs and giant beak, the heron is too slow and cumbersome compared to the osprey, which soars away with its scaly meal. The scene plays out in the Haw River as it runs through the concrete hill of that Jordan Lake Dam on its way to the sea. The Army Corps of Engineers built the dam in 1974 to flood the valley, holding back about 70 billion gallons of water to form the Triangle's favorite spot for fishing, boating, and drawing municipal drinking water. For years, taps in Wake and Chatham counties have sucked from the lake. Now, as the flow of newcomers for the Triangle grows from a trickle to a flood, the city of Durham is about to get thirstier than its current reservoirs can manage. The city of Durham, in partnership with Chatham, Orange, and the town of Pittsburgh, wants to stick its own straw into Jordan Lake by 2029. Local water planners hope that, unlike the osprey and the heron, the municipal governments surrounding the lake can cooperate to share its resources. It's the kind of government work that frankly doesn't seem to matter that much until you turn your tap on and nothing comes out. Durham employees say the city isn't close to that yet. Sydney Miller, Water Resource Director for City of Durham, says, "We plan 50 years out. Without this plan, it would take about 10 years for people to notice some new restrictions on water usage. You'd be getting much more frequent calls from the utility saying, 'We need you to start conserving water. No more outdoor water. Can't do any pressure washing. Car washes? Nope. We need you to cut back on the showers you take. We need you to reduce the number of times you wash laundry.'" The plan, still in initial phases, is to build a water intake on the west side of the lake. That pipeline will flow into a new water treatment plant before being sent through transmission pipelines to join the existing infrastructure for distribution, supplementing Durham's roughly 28 million gallons per day from Lake Mishi and Little River Reservoir. Planners say the new intake would not impact Jordan Lake's current uses as a recreation hub and a water source for other parts of the triangle. Miller says that one of the tenets of the water partnership is to ensure that, in meeting our own current and future needs for water, we in no way compromise the ability of those downstream communities in meeting their own current and future needs. That's a much more neighborly tone than exists out west, where states and native nations are locked in legal disputes over a very limited resource. Miller says, "We actually have more water available in comparison to our needs, so we don't have quite the strain on our resources that they do." Local environmental groups aren't ringing the alarm over this project, but they're cautious about the potential downside of allocating more of the lake's water supply. Elaine Chioso, head of local nonprofit Haw River Assembly, says, "If we have worse droughts due to climate change, I don't believe that was factored in. There's a lot of attention being paid to water conservation, and perhaps this will all work out in the end, but I do worry that not enough attention is paid to the impacts of just constantly drawing down water. In the droughts of the 2000s, water levels dipped low enough to reveal some of the submerged roads under the lake." Chioso says droughts like that, coupled with the increased human use, can have negative impacts on wildlife, saying, "I think it's very hard for us as humans to think about the carrying capacity of a landscape for humans." James Lim, Durham's water efficiency manager, says the city started focusing on water management in the 1990s with a pair of bond referenda. And in the 2000s, a pair of droughts got residents thinking about how to conserve water even in non-drought times. Lim says if we use less water, that's the same as buying more water or acquiring more. So we really want to encourage people to think about efficiency and conservation as a resource, as opposed to making a sacrifice or reducing a standard of living. Chioso says that as North Carolina and its metro areas like Durham grow, lawmakers at the state level need to assume more responsibility in making sure natural resources are protected and managed in ways that are conducive to sustainable growth. Quote, "We need a legislature that's willing to pass rules that will protect the environment and to fund staffing. There are so many vacant positions in important environmental jobs in the state of North Carolina right now. It's really kind of shocking." And another one published the day before the 4th of July. The Durham Public School Board of Education unanimously voted to appoint Anthony Lewis as the district's next superintendent. Former Superintendent Pascal Mubenga resigned in February following that pay dispute that I've read every week for weeks and weeks and weeks. Lewis was selected from a pool of over 100 applicants, narrowed down to 4 finalists. I think that's all the details we need now. Oh, back up to the current issue. The Durham community fridges operate with a spirit of abundance. This is, and there are some Durham community fridge locations. One is at St. Joseph's Episcopal Church on West Main Street, and another part and parcel on Chapel Hill Road. And the article says, it's an 86-degree summer day in late June. Remember those? Open a painted door of a refrigerator. This one's set next to the garden bed at Lakewood Bulk Store, part and parcel. And you'll find stacks of rainbow chard, a few cantaloupes, 2 pints of blueberries, and a drawer full of beets. Fresh produce is abundant this season, but on another given day, you might find the refrigerator stocked with pre-made sandwiches, containers of soup, loaves of bread, and much more. In October of 2022, the new local organization, Durham Community Fridges, DCF, launched with its first community fridge in the Triangle, located at St. Joseph's Church on West Main. What began as a group of passionate individuals has since grown into an expansive network of volunteers, partners, and coordinators, all with a shared belief in access to free food for all. A second fridge opened at Part and Parcel in 2023, and there are now plans for a third to begin operating this year outside Omi's Coffee Shop. DCF hopes to expand to more neighborhoods in Durham to increase food access for the community. Earlier this year, the network also expanded to Chapel Hill with a fridge hosted by the Community Empowerment Fund. Community fridges tend to be set up as refrigerators, freezers, and food pantries where anyone can drop off or take food. They often act as a way to mitigate waste, with restaurants, organizations, and households dropping off surplus food. During the COVID pandemic, when nonprofit organizations were overwhelmed with high rates of need and federal aid lagged, mutual aid groups stepped in to fill the gaps. Community Fridge Database, FREEDGE, FREEDGE, currently lists 375 of these fridges in the United States, a growing number that reflects growing food insecurity issues. In 2023, 27% of adults in the country experienced food insecurity, an increase from nearly 25% in the previous year. In Durham, volunteers regularly table at community events, spreading awareness about the organization and distributing free food to community members where they are. Such events include the monthly Really, Really Free Market and, more recently, rallies supporting Palestine. Now, many of the places that I read in this article are in the IndieWeek.com, our websites. I don't have the web addresses, but you can do a search for things like Really, Really Free Market and probably find them. Bo Borek, a member of the DCF team, says, we've been to different Palestine rallies, and that, of course, intersects with our work very importantly. Food apartheid over there has the same roots as the food apartheid here. We really see our work very interconnected with the Palestinian struggle in that way. Taylor Holdenbeck, another DCF organizer, says to a lot of people, protesting against genocide seems radical, but to me, it's human. And the same thing here. To give out free food could be perceived as a radical act, but it's really just a human act because it's just a right. Just as life is right, food is a right. Hollenbach works as the grower services coordinator at Happy Dirt, a produce distributor that focuses on organic produce and the creation of more sustainable food systems. And Borek teaches at Lakewood Montessori Middle School. Both Hollenbach and Borek have dedicated significant time and resources to DCF since its inception. Hollenbach even donated his own refrigerator, which became the first Durham community fridge. Nonprofit Candor, C-A-N-D-O-R, runs Part and Parcel. That's the host of DCF's second community location. As eco-conscious, package-free grocery store, Part and Parcel's business is modeled on disability, economic, environmental, and food justice movements, making it an ideal partner for DCF. Even before playing host to the Fridge, Part and Parcel became a partner in the biweekly West End Free Market in Lyon Park. The market distributes fresh produce from local farms and dry goods from Part and Parcel, free of charge, to 85 households. Candor founder T. Land explains that every single access point that's trying to enhance the food security of people, there are parameters around it. And as much as we try to remove those obstacles, for example, you don't have to prove need when you shop with us at the market, and there aren't limits. But you do have to be there on a Thursday at 2 o'clock. With a community fridge, there those other barriers aren't there either, but a community fridge is 24/7. No matter your schedule, you can get there. If you can get there, you can get food. DCF is a mutual aid effort, not a nonprofit, which dictates its structure and operations. Hollenbeck explains, "We have no fiscal sponsors or financial backing at all. We purely operate off of our time as the biggest resource and the community pitching in and donating food to the fridges." There are many benefits to the mutual aid model. There are also realistic challenges. Borek explains, the nonprofit relies on the current capitalist structure. They have more resources. They have more agility. We're more interconnected, and we're reliant on the community, which maybe moves slower, but to me is more abundant and stronger. Not relying on donations or grant funds means DCF doesn't adjust goals and values to align with funders' requests or grant requirements. Resources are more limited, but they're also more consistent and reliable, say the organizers. Still, other local for-profit and nonprofit organizations pitch in. Regular food donations are received from Begging for Kids, Root Causes, Feed Durham, Whole Foods, and other sources. Hollenbeck says, we've seen a lot of those rescue orgs utilize the fridges as places to take the food they're rescuing instead of certain pantries. It's a much more accessible and immediate place to take food that gets typically taken the same day. There are very few hard and fast guidelines when it comes to community fridges. An intentional ethos, according to the organizers. Close oversight can create additional barriers for people in need. The open nature, though, does come with its own challenges. Some community members and fridge visitors have expressed concern that people may abuse the system and take more than their fair share, leaving nothing for the next person. A few months ago, I made a drop-off at the first location at St. Joseph's Episcopal, and after unloading, an Uber driver who was parked on the street and waiting to schedule a ride waved me over to his car. He began by thanking me for bringing over the surplus food and then relayed that he'd regularly seen people visiting the fridge and nearly emptying it of its contents. Several volunteers and fridge visitors have also expressed concern that some people may be reselling the food. Nevertheless, Hollenbeck contends you can honestly have as much as you want. It's not our place to govern that or to surveil. One way DCF has responded to this challenge is by creating fridge status updates on its website. Visitors can submit a form reporting how full the fridge is, what its contents are, and offer feedback on what they'd like to see more of. And Land says there are probably so many things that people think are going to be problems, and it's an imagined deterrent from someone being able to set up something like that in their own spaces. And we just haven't hit any kind of a challenge that has ever outweighed the benefit. Next, now from Durham, Lena Geller, authors this called Stronger Familias. That's a question and answer with Luke Smith, who's the founder and executive director of El Futuro, a local nonprofit that provides mental health services to Latino communities, will receive nearly $500,000 in funding over the next 2 years from Alliance Health. That's a managed care organization, MCO, that serves uninsured residents and Medicaid recipients in the Triangle. The funding will go toward expanding El Futuro's Mentes Fuertes, or Strong Minds, program, which launched earlier this year. Mentes Fuertes draws inspiration from the Promotoros movement in Latin America that sees people who are already trusted and ingrained within a community trained to serve as mental health workers for their friends and neighbors. Mentes Fuertes currently employs 4 bilingual community health workers and has enrolled 78 participants to date. The $460,000 commitment that Alliance Health announced last week comes about a year after the MCO furnished $500,000 to get Mentes Fuertes off the ground. The funding reflects a feat of community organizing that came in response to the refusal of Cardinal Innovation, Alliance's predecessor, to fund mental health services for undocumented immigrants. Groups including Orange County Justice United and the North Carolina Congress of Latino Organizations began organizing around the issue early in the pandemic and spent 2 years building people power before organizing the Accountability Assembly that attracted more than 300 residents and pushed Alliance to make its first contribution. So the Indy spoke, says Lena Geller, with El Futuro founder and executive director Luke Smith, a psychiatrist, to learn more about the community-driven approach to mental health care that the money from Alliance is helping to support. And she begins, can you talk about the evolution of El Futuro's relationship with managed care organizations? El Futuro was founded in Carrboro, 2004. Our mission? To nurture stronger familias to live out their dreams. We look for individuals and families who are suffering mental health or substance use problems in the Latino community and try to deliver a service that will help them. A bunch of people came together to bring this work about. Social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists. In 2012, the state, which contracted with what then were called LMEs, local management entities, now known as these MCOs, put a local management entity in place in Orange and Chatham counties called Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions. When Cardinal came in, it immediately said it would no longer provide any type of funding for services for people who are undocumented. That impacted a significant number of people that we served. Around 2015, we found offering services in Orange County was going to cause us to not be solvent. We were going to go bankrupt because of the lack of funding from Cardinal, which was a proxy for the state and the county. County commissioners select this organization, which contracts with HHS, brings down funding from the state, and distributes grant funding from the federal government. We weren't getting that money, and we found our work in Orange and Chatham to really suffer because of that. We were able to keep our clinics in Durham and Siler City open, but had to shut down in Carrboro. I appreciate you walking me through the context. Why this story becomes so incredible, in the fall of 2022, a grassroots group made up primarily of churches, including a lot of people from St. Thomas More, the Latino parish, came together in Orange County and said, this is not right. We're not getting services. It doesn't matter if we're undocumented or what our status is. This is a basic human right. And it actually, the federal government agrees with that. There's a precedent that mental health is kind of like tuberculosis or HIV/AIDS or the COVID-19 pandemic. It's communicable. There was a big community meeting at Binkley Baptist Church Everybody from the state senators to county commissioners to school board members were there, and the community made demands. This was very different from when we exited in 2016 in a little cloud of dust. The very community we're serving found its voice powerfully, went to decision makers in the front of the room and said, "These are my demands. Will you agree to them or not?" And one by one, those decision makers said, "Yes, yes, yes." There were tears of joy. And the community says, "Well, we just got you on tape, and we're going to check in with you in 6 months to see how things are going." So now we come back to the drawing board. As it turns out, we found ourselves very closely partnered with Alliance Health, which is the MCO over Orange County, Durham County, and other counties, including Mecklenburg and Johnston. We came to the table with them in a very let's-do-this kind of manner. We said to them, we could start another clinic in Orange County, but we found there's another intervention that's really powerful, and it's Spanish-speaking community mental health workers. Tell me about the bilingual community mental health worker approach. When El Futuro was founded, we envisioned we would be working within churches and schools and primary care clinics and community organizations. We have an appreciation that mental health isn't just getting people into an office for therapy, psychiatry, and substance use counseling. It's being out in the community. We tried to do that, but the system doesn't really pay for that type of service very well. You need grant funding to do that kind of work. But then, during the pandemic, Department of Health and Human Services began to employ what in Latin America are called promotores de salud, or community health workers. With the urgency of things, all of a sudden, there was a full-scale implementation. It's a very time-tested model throughout Latin America. One of El Futuro's board members, Gabby Livas-Stein, along with a partner at Harvard, had begun to test an approach back in 2017. This was a new frontier. They tested an intervention that found that after 3 months of training, someone who has trust or confianza, somebody who has street cred in the community, can go out and provide 10 sessions of very foundational mental health support for individuals who are struggling. So we told Alliance, if you would give us the money, we think we can make it go further and be more effective by finding individuals who can do this work in Orange County and employing them. Earlier this year in January, we began that work. It's been lights out amazing. We advertised it once on a Facebook Live post, and automatically 48 people signed up. The community health workers went to churches and rape crisis centers. They offered these sessions right there in the community and in trusted places. And it's been tremendous. People are getting better. They felt valued and supported. So about a month ago, we went back to Alliance and said, this is really working. And they said, we're excited about it. We had employed 4 community health workers full-time. They said, we want to help you make them full-time. That must be part-time. So the new funding from Alliance will be going towards salaries for those workers? Yes, initially. These are individuals who are on the front lines. When they first started, we were hearing them say things like, this person is expressing feelings of suicidality, and I really don't know how to handle that. Or, this is really hard for me. I don't know how to get up and do this work again tomorrow. It's really hard getting their feet wet. I was 9 years into training before I got to the point of taking care of patients. They're doing it after 3 months of training. So we have to provide really good supervision support for them in order for them to stay for the long term and provide quality work. What you see in these individuals is that they're thinking holistically. Oftentimes, in the academic world that we've created, we don't think holistically. Watching their intuition to really be community-driven and anchor themselves in community feedback is something that we are all learning from them. Can you speak to what the need for mental health services looks like for Latino communities in Orange County right now? A lot of our work begins with people who are struggling with mood disorders like depression or anxiety. They've suffered from some kind of traumatic experience in their home country or during the migration journey or when they get here. Discrimination is one of the big things people report. We call them acculturation stresses, disruption of family networks, being estranged from family, going into new environments feeling isolated or othered. We're trying to increase their ability to buffer those acculturative stresses. The data shows the longer they live in a community, the less ability they have to buffer against those stresses, and they actually have worse health outcomes the longer they live in the host nation. So an immigrant comes here and they're actually healthier, but as they live here, they succumb more and more to those stresses. What does the community health workers model look like in practice? There's 10 sessions. We want to be able to work with them for some length of time. We really stop, listen to their stories, meet them where they're at, and also bring these tools, behavioral activation, motivational interviewing, supportive care, self-care, mindfulness activities, a lot of things, in a way that the next time a crisis comes up, they're able to deal with it. What we've seen is that after the 10 sessions, people are really able to go on their merry way and get back into life. Traditional treatments like psychiatry or therapy are good, but we need to look upstream to think about building resilience and building engagements. Here are some things that can help. Strengthening family, connecting them to community resources, helping them with their hopeful orientation that they don't lose hope. Another one I love to talk about is cultural pride. One of our board members, Rosa Gonzalez-Garda, she's a dean in the School of Nursing at Duke, she did a really foundational research project that found when a person who is Latino feels more pride in their culture, they will experience less depression and less anxiety. If a young girl who is 15 years old has a quinceañera, for instance, she's going to be less vulnerable to the stresses that cause depression, anxiety, and so on. So, since launching Mentes Fuertes, our community health workers have been organizing events. We had celebrations for the Dia de los Muertos, for the Posadas, for Dia de las Madres, or Mother's Day. Hundreds of people came. So these community health workers are not just doing these sessions, but they're also helping us to cultivate that cultural pride, and that becomes a treatment intervention. Finally, question, what kind of specific benefits does this approach have? Something that we're seeing is a better uptake from men. Oftentimes, women are the primary users of mental health services proportionately. But we're seeing that more men are actually seeking this kind of help. Why it's working, I think, is a cornerstone of trust. Our values here at El Futuro are confianza, calor humano, which is human worth, warmth, and authenticity, and then respeto, respect. That means meeting them where they are, maybe in how they want to be called, or what their type of Spanish or indigenous language is, or going to the place they feel most at home, which is at a site like a church. The key foundational element of this that's making it work is that they are moving along lines of trust. All right, I'm going to hit a few cultural articles now, and the first is by Sarah Edwards, and it's about Carolina Days, Carolina D-A-Z-E. It's a new music festival, and it's bringing momentum to North Carolina voters. Over the past few years, writes Sarah Edwards, Gino Nuzzolillo has been packing up his car and hitting the road to help put on town halls across the state. Nuzzolillo, 26, works with the nonprofit Common Cause North Carolina. The town halls, which touched down in 25 different counties, first began their push when Moore versus Harper, a case about redistricting in the state, reached the U.S. Supreme Court. In town halls sprawling from Greensville to Silva, Nuzzolillo and his Common Cause colleagues regularly laid out the stakes of the gerrymandered congressional maps the Republican legislature had drawn. People showed up to the rooms of folding chairs and spoke and listened, a heartening demonstration of democracy in action. Not many, though, represented a vital new voting bloc, Gen Z. And who can blame them? Nuzzolillo explains over a Zoom call, people who looked like me were not coming to a town hall at 6 p.m. on like a Thursday night. We wanted to put something together that would meet young people like us where we were at, that would recognize and take seriously that nobody under the age of 35 is at all remotely excited about what they have to vote for this year, and that's especially true after last week. Enter Carolina Days, a new music and arts festival series Common Cause North Carolina has just launched. The events, featuring a mix of homegrown and national talent, will take place this fall across the state. Earlier today, this nonpartisan organization announced its first installation of the series, scheduled September 14th at Raleigh's Red Hat Amphitheater. This first concert will feature Tar Heel heavy hitters Tierra Whack, Lute, Moses Sumney, and Helado Negro. Tickets go on sale today, July the 11th, for $35 to $40. You can get access to $25 pre-sale tickets are live from July 8th through 10th. That's over now. That's a notably low price point for a multi-artist lineup. Hopscotch, which takes place in Raleigh a few days prior, sells three-day passes for $160. One-night ticket for Sylvan Esso's recent Good Moon concert in Durham started at $73. An Asheville festival will be announced later this month with more locations and dates to follow. Raleigh musician Tift Merritt, an advisor for the concert series, wrote in the press release, I've been working in the music industry for decades and Carolina Days stands out. Every decision, from artist lineup to the branding to the vendors to the organizations this series will benefit, has been lovingly made with young people not only in mind, but also in leadership. Characterized as a movement-building event, the September concert will also feature remarks from community leaders and tabling from local nonprofits and arts vendors. The goal, Nuzzolillo says, is to advance Common Cause's mission of driving voter turnout, but also to politically mobilize Gen Z beyond the election. He says, we want to give young people like myself a chance to see a vision of what democracy can look like in North Carolina that goes beyond a slogan, that goes beyond just going to the ballot box, where we can actually hear from people who are organizing in different parts of the state and see the diversity of people coming together who want more. A new vision of democracy may be welcome to young voters whose optimism about the future and the Democratic Party, as reflected in the polls, does not burn very bright. While protests against Israel's war on Gaza, on and off college campuses, and now inching toward a 10-month mark, speaks to renewed political energy, President Biden's rigid stance on the issue has proven unpopular with young voters. Polling from April, before that lackluster debate showing, evidenced the president squeaking ahead with younger voters by only a 2-point lead. In 2020, by contrast, exit polling had a 24-point Biden lead among these 18 to 29-year-old voters. But much can change between now and November, and as Nuzzolillo emphasizes, Common Cause North Carolina is hoping to encourage voters to turn out for down-ballot races as well, especially with a high-stakes gubernatorial race between Josh Stein and the ultra-conservative Mark Robinson on that ballot. Sailor Jones, Associate Director of Common Cause North Carolina and a longtime activist in the region, ties the organization's focus on youth voters to previous political struggles in the state. And Jones says, anyone who's between the ages of 20 and 50 in North Carolina is looking for something to fight for and against. The biggest rallying cries we've had in the state of North Carolina have been Amendment 1, HB 2, and the Moral Monday movement. They were all defensive efforts against a repressive legislature and executive branch in a state where we were taking a red wave turn in a way that was hurting everyone. This is an effort to give us something to fight for once, an affirmative vision that goes well beyond 2024. A portion of proceeds from the September 14th concert will go to Southern Grassroots Groups, Center for Racial Equality in Education, Seven Directions of Service, Carolina Abortion Fund, Campaign for Southern Equality, the Carolina Migrant Network, and the HBCU Student Action Alliance. What's driving a lot of young people, says Nuzzolillo, we say that because that's the work we do every day, and we just want thousands more people to be able to see and hear that too. And now, if you're interested in this article by Sarah Edwards, you can, of course, see it at theindieweek.com or read it. But this is also Common Cause North Carolina. We'll have plenty of details on Carolina Days. But once again, tickets go on sale today, $35 to $40. That's September 14th. I think that's a one-day festival this year. And we'll see how that goes. And it looks like... I've been so budget conscious with my time that I can read three music reviews and talk chats about music. The first by Jordan Lawrence. In fact, two of them are by Jordan Lawrence. And the first one's about Radio Haw, H-A-W's Council of Spirits, which is released on self-released on May 31st. Council of Serpents, the debut full length from Pittsburgh musician Matt Gray's musical project, Radio Haw, is adept at conjuring the spirits of the many folk music forebears who inspired him. It calls to mind The Tallest Man on Earth's early efforts. Gray's album has a different feel, hypnotic and slithering, but like The Tallest Man, is similarly consumed by the shadow of Dylan, while carving out a distinct and personal vibe. Gray's online bio asserts the album could sit on a shelf between Elliott Smith and Bad Debt, the intimate early acoustic album from Durham's His Golden Messenger. While his own prowess, both in sound and words, is outstripped by the greats he's in conversation with, Council of Serpents makes it easier to believe Gray might grow to make his own lasting mark. Album opener, Someone Dosed the Fiddler, is a Dylan-esque dirge that sticks remarkably close to his oft-imitated style. But while such a move could prove insufferable, Gray, who plays most everything besides drums, manages it admirably. As organ swirls above determined strums and drums like a spell, drawing unsuspecting souls towards certain doom, Gray offers weary rhymes that feel the dread of his own fraught period in history. Ghosts dance in smoke as shots start flying. Our great lady tall wavers, falls, clings on her aisle and calls, I'm dying. Grand Old Medicine Show comes close to the profundity His Golden Messenger manages when expressing frustration with religious strictures, questioning whether there's any difference between peddling faith and selling snake oil. Another song, A Change, is the best show of Gray's potential, echoing out a tangle of effects-laden guitar and keyboard as he poignantly grapples to untangle his anxiety from their causes and his own temporary remedies. I need a change in my state of mind. I've been seeing too clearly for too long a time, he moans, before keying on the tensions learned. I once was lost, and I might not be found, but at least I'm not going back that way this time around. He isn't there yet, concludes Jordan Lawrence's column, but in following the path set down by songwriting luminaries, Gray is quickly finding ways to branch out and make statements of his own. And Lawrence's rating for this release, Council of Serpents, is 3 stars. I think 5 is the maximum. No, 5. Yeah, 5. 3 out of 5. And his next effort in music criticism is from Jake Xerxes Fussell, F-U-S-S-E-L-L, and it's a release called When I'm Called. And Mr. Lawrence gives us 4.5 stars. Released on July 12th from Fat Possum Records. It's the 5th album from Durham guitarist and singer Fussell, but it feels like the first that's really a Jake Fussell album. For the better part of a decade, Fussell has blown the dust from and breathed new life into songs from folk music's forgotten corners, proving himself an expressive arranger, an attentive scholar, packaging charmingly antiquated lyrics within music that sometimes rollicks and sometimes broods, always balancing reverence with a keen sense of what the songs mean in the present. His earlier albums feel motivated by a sense of responsibility to maintain tradition, but in When I'm Called, he switched things up, sketching melodies first and then picking songs that work with them. Populated with songs that consistently find characters at varying moments of transition, it's enhanced by Fussell's clear-eyed baritone, as well as rich and airy arrangement, played by a variety of gifted backers. Multi-instrumentalist and producer James Elkington, bassist Ben Whiteley, and drummer Joe Westerland form the core. The album doesn't come across as solely anchored to the past. Rather, it's adrift in the expanse of time, feeling both the burden and the freedom of folk music's long tradition and Fussell's fleeting time carrying the torch. Travel songs loop, repeating their first verse at the end, suggesting that the rider on the opening song, Andy, guided by the blearily grinning lope of Fussell's solitary guitar, will constantly be chasing his goal of taking Andy Warhol's star. That the narrator of Leaving Here, Don't Know Where I'm Going, carried along by elegantly intertwining guitars, bass, drums, and horns, will always be departing. Chance meetings sear at the brain, but don't last in the physical world. On Feeing Day, an encounter with a bonny lass ends with them forgetting their troubles. Glass after glass, the time did pass before the song fades into a haze of relaxed strums, resolute horns, and entrancing acoustic drone. A fun and rambunctious animal tale is haunted by death and responsibility. Giddy picking can't outrun the drums and piano that commandingly thrum on Who Killed Poor Robin, as the lethal sparrow, the grave-digging crow, and more all do their part to carry the deceased to ground. The owl declares, I'll scream and I'll howl when he preaches the funeral, but it won't change what happened. None of these moves are, on their face, new or revelatory, but on When I'm Called, Fussell displays the depth of feeling they inspire in him, and that is where the magic happens. Jordan Lawrence giving When I'm Called 4.5 stars for Jake Fussell's When I'm Called, Fat Possum Records. And really but a moment to list a 4-star review by Brian Howe of Bats and Mice, the release P.S. Seriously on Love It Records, which came out May 31st. In 2020, Brian Howe writes, I wrote an indie feature on the lost era of indie rock, arguing that local bands who made their impact circa 2000 had largely been forgotten because they weren't covered by the major press like 90s bands or captured on the internet like later ones. 4 years on, I'm still regularly slapping my forehead when I remember someone I left out. Though at least that does lend support to the premise. But really, how the hell did I forget Bats and Mice? Releasing its debut EP in 2000 and its lone album, Believe It Mammals, 2 years ago, this Chapel Hill trio was one of the hottest local vendors of what we then called post-hardcore, because each generation makes up its own name for prettifying punk. A developmental stage that explains how emo got from sunny day real estate to My Chemical Romance. Though Bats and Mice had all the soaring, desperate yelping you could want, they were subtler and more atmospheric than some shamelessly overwrought peers, heavily dosed with Joy Division, setting their livid outbursts against eerie, curving melodies and dark-hued guitar textures. They had multiple singers, and you could even sort of tell them apart, but they were all in other bands, and they eked out just two more short EPs. 14 years since the last one, they're back with a new full-length. P.S. Seriously and honestly, it's way better than it should be. This isn't just the boys dusting off the old stuff for a nostalgic cruise around the block. It's a worthy follow-up Mammals always deserved, the sound intact, but respectably matured, the band's delivering the goods without trying to squeeze back into their skinny jeans. And there's a good bit of background on Bats and Mice and the changing personnel, and I have no time to read it, but P.S. Seriously on Love It Records has given a 4-star review by Mr. Brian Howe. And that brings Indie Week to a close for this issue. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service. It's available after its initial play on Friday afternoon in the podcast section of ncreadingservice.org, and you can find thousands of earlier issues of the same, formerly called The Independent, now Indie Week and indieweek.com. So for the North Carolina Reading Service, we'll be back next week with our next weekly issue, of course, of Indie Week. Bye-bye, everybody.